Colloquium, Episode 12, Robot Parts, Brian Clevenger on Atomic Robo. Welcome to Colloquium. My name is Mark Asan, and this is my comics creator interview podcast for SecWart. I recently had a chance to talk with writer Brian Clevenger, whose Eisner Award-nominated series Atomic Robo has been universally praised for its Indiana Jones meets Rocketeer-style adventures. Brian and co-creator Scott Wegener have completed 9 volumes of Robo in 7 years. They've launched the spin-off anthology series, Atomic Robo Presents Real Science Adventures, and even debuted a role-playing game based on Atomic Robo's world and cast of characters. In January, they took a brave step toward the future. They allowed their publishing contract with Red 5 Comics to expire and will now completely handle Robo's adventures themselves through their company, Tesladyne LLC. Atomic Robo is currently transitioning into a digital-first comic that will be offered for free on the website, atomic-robo.com. Brian and Scott will be uploading the entire Robo library at a rate of 3 issues a week. When they're done with that, all new pages from Volume 10, Atomic Robo and the Ring of Fire, will be posted. I talked to Brian before this big digital announcement, so we don't discuss that transition. But please check out their newly launched Patreon to help keep Robo going strong at patreon.com/tesladyne. Okay, let's get to the interview. I talked to Brian about writing historical figures and places, translating Atomic Robo into an RPG, the origin of Dr. Dinosaur, and why a robot needs pants for every adventure. Thanks for taking the time to talk to me about Atomic Robo.
No problem.
I mean, it's a series I got into late. My friend recommended it, but I really, really enjoy it now.
Good. What the hell took you so long?
You know, I don't know. It, you know, all ages types books don't usually fly on my radar, I guess.
Yeah.
I tend to read more like Vertigo type stuff.
Yeah, we're the opposite end of that.
Definitely. But just as fun.
Yeah, it's you know, we're often called all ages, but I don't, because there's nothing there that's offensive to kids. But I feel like we're a bit more of a hard PG or PG-13.
Yeah, I can see that. Yeah, definitely. I mean, definitely not R-rated.
No.
All right, well, let's start off by letting people know what the book is all about. How do you describe the series to people?
I have a quickie pitch that I'd give about 100 times at every convention, and the people who end up sitting next to us must hate me for it every single time, at least by the end of the show, because they've heard it, you know, 1,000 times.
Mm-hmm. So you're going to do something different, or are you going to do that?
No, I'm doing that. Okay. You're getting the official, this is the con experience. For everyone who can't make it to a show that we go to, here it is. You take Ghostbusters, Indiana Jones, Buckaroo Banzai, Rocketeer, cram all of that into a robot, give that robot some pants, and that's Atomic Robo.
That's great. Well, I know it's a PG-13 book, Brian, but it is a little sad to me that all his adventures have to be with pants on.
Yeah, that's probably for the best.
So why did you want to do a book about a robot?
That's a ridiculous question. Robots are cool.
Well, what I like about Robo is that he isn't trying to be human. He's kind of accepted as a person in his world, but, you know, he isn't trying to fit in and be something he's not. He's cool with being a robot.
Yeah, he, there's been that story about 100 times, right? The robot who wants to be human. You know, we all know Lieutenant Commander Data from Star Trek. We all know, you know, destroys of that nature. You know, so why do one more? You know, why not? Wouldn't it be more interesting if he's just his robotness is almost secondary. You know, he's just this person, happens to live a very long time, happens to have a life full of adventure, and he just happens to be a robot.
Now, was this idea for Robo something you worked on for a while before it became an actual book?
Oh, golly, yeah. It started off very differently. About 1996, I was trying to cash in on what was then sort of the beginning of the big anime spike, you know, in American popularity. So Robo was a very different project at the time. It was more like, you know, those robot battle like clubs and TV shows they had for a while there?
Sure, yeah.
Science clubs that build robots and, you know, they battle each other. It was like that, but, you know, times 1,000, you know, it was just amped up and really crazy. And Robo was one of these projects that was built to battle with the robots, you know, a little touch of Mega Man, a little touch of Dexter's Lab, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Which I guess sounds interesting enough, but the actual guts of it just didn't click with me. It was too much of a cash-in idea. So just sort of sat on this, you know, robot character for a while and just let it percolate in the back of my mind for a few years. And eventually it just became this way to explore things that I'm really interested in, which would be history, sci-fi, science history, alternate history. And just became this way to approach, you know, all kinds of stories dealing with history and sci-fi all through the vessel of one character, so you wouldn't have to reinvent a whole setting every time you wanted to tell a different kind of story. And so, you know, we can follow Robo throughout his life, and he has adventures, high-flying adventures in the Pacific in the 50s, and he's got, you know, pulp adventures in the 30s, and he's got sort of modern-day born style conspiracy adventures in the modern day. You know, we can do a lot with this character and have a lot of fun with it.
Now, was it originally conceived to be a comic book, or was it just an idea you had that you developed for maybe a different type of a project?
No, it was always supposed to be a comic, just because that's the easiest thing to get done, you know?
Yeah, it does seem like it is. So how did you and Scott meet and start working on the series together then?
Complete random chance. By the time that I sort of reimagined Robo to be much closer to what we know now, that would have been about 2006. And I just started looking for artists online. And went through, I'd say, half a dozen or so who rejected it for one reason or another, you know, too busy or just not their kind of project, whatever. And I gave up for a little while and just by sheer chance came across Scott's website and saw what he was doing with his online gallery and his art style, and I thought, well, it's got to be this guy or it's going to be nobody. And luckily he said yes.
Now, did you have a definitive design in mind for Robo when you pitched the book to Scott, or did he really develop
Robo's design is completely Scott. He drew hundreds of versions before we settled on what we have today. The only input I had really was that he should be a little short, and just his face is just the eyes. There's no mouth or nose or anything. And that's it.
Mm-hmm. And why did you want him to not have a mouth or nose or anything like that?
You know, on robots, it can look a little creepy. But really, my thinking was Hello Kitty. Because that's a brand. That is a powerful multi-billion-dollar brand based on just an expressionless cat. You know, the most important thing for Robo to be, you know, it's really easy for people to be drawn into Robo, the design that he has visually. Because we have, you know, there's a nice picture of him for the banner that we put behind us at shows. And we often have people that are just walking by, kind of glancing at everything, taking it all in. And you can see their gaze lock on Robo and they're just instantly engaged and they walk straight to us. And it's like, you know, tell me about this thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a basic psychology. He's got these big, friendly eyes. You know, we're humans. We're hardwired to be drawn to that sort of thing. So it's a very cynical design idea, but, you know, hey, it works.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing how much expression Scott gets out of those eyes.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Just, a few little arcs, eyelids this way and that way, and some body language, and you know, you can communicate so much. The irony is that lack of there being facial features really helps to communicate his expressions because, you know, we as humans are so hardwired to read expressions that given less of a palette because there's less there to manipulate, tiny little changes in that frame can communicate a great deal more than you would expect.
As humans, we always look for the human expressions in other life forms. I just did an interview recently with Jay Ferber on Copperhead, and they have all aliens in there. And you know, I'm trying to figure out what these aliens look like. I want to relate to them from my human experience.
Yeah.
Well, you mentioned Hello Kitty, and I just thought of something. You know, Hello Kitty has the huge head and little body. I always wanted to create a Goodbye Kitty who had a small head and a huge body.
Creepy.
Well, okay, so given the pulp and pants adventure style of the series, were there any specific stories you read in pulp that influenced the direction of the book?
I'd say more the sort of neo-pulp of 80s adventure movies, you know, all the ones that I mentioned earlier. Those were an enormous influence on my youth. I still love them today.
What's your favorite one?
Oof. Probably, I guess it would have to be objectively Ghostbusters. Because that's really got it all.
It really does. I just saw the re-release in the theater. It was awesome.
Oh, wow. Yeah, we there was a local theater here that did a last year at Halloween. You know, so I got to see it in the theater again. The first time in whatever it's been, 20 years. Or...
It's amazing how funny it still is, how it holds up.
Oh, yeah, because, yeah. Just amazing performances, great script.
So at this point, you've worked on Robo with Scott for many years. How has working with each other changed or evolved from when you first started until now?
Well, it was always easy in that even though Scott and I, you know, we're not lifetime friends or whatever, and you know, we're friends now through the book, through working together every damn day for whatever it's been, 7 years now. But so much of our influences were very similar. You know, we were both big role-playing game nerds. We loved slash hated Palladium's Rift RPG game, the Robotech game, and just tons of others. So we have a certain common language with regard to, you know, I can say in just a couple sentences, I can imply to Scott, because we have such a shared background, you know, a whole huge description, and then he can take it in whatever direction he wants to go. So you know, there's a lot of back and forth. We've evolved to have more and more with every series. Each one of us, I think, shoring up the shortcomings of the other. You know, I don't tend to think of pages very well. I don't feel visually. You know, I'm more concerned with sort of the beats and the narrative and making sure that something interesting is happening on every page. And narratively, at least. So then, you know, that kind of leaves Scott in the lurch. He's got to figure out, you know, how am I supposed to make this actually look like something, you know, that somebody's going to want to read, and how can I make it flow, you know, just right to fit this impossible, you know, structure that Brian wants.
Right.
So then he'll draw whatever, you know, whatever works, what, you know, getting close to whatever was in the script. And then I go back and re-script to, you know, better match what he's drawn. Because sometimes he'll introduce... In fact, this is how we've gotten most of the personalities for the action scientists. Because he'll just introduce these little facial tics and other and characters just that seem innocent, but if you just tweak the dialogue, then suddenly they've got it. There's a specific take on that delivery. You know, it's a little extra sassy, or it's a little extra mad, or whatever. And then from there, we've kind of collaboratively, using the cloud of our creative, I don't know, expressions, created these personalities as we've gone forward. It's been a lot of fun to sort of discover things about Robo's world that neither one of us knew about. In a slightly more specific way, there's essentially what this means is that by the time we finish the book, we have trouble pointing out what each of us actually thought of.
All
right. Like there'll be like a line, like in volume four, the fans are really fond of this visual gag, these like armored plates come down over the windows, and it says, you know, remain calm, trust in science. Neither one of us knows which one of us came up with that line. Just because there's so much back and forth, you know, it just happens.
It's great, because it's almost like a mini Marvel style after you've done the script, and then he gets it and draws it.
Oh, yeah.
So have you ever had any big disagreements on the book?
There's nothing that I would say was big. The one that I keep coming back to, and this was so early on that I don't know that I can even blame Scott, because neither one of us had yet we didn't yet have a completely solid feeling for Robo's world, you know, what we would want to allow to be possible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like we blanket, there's just no aliens. Or if there are, they're just never going to be introduced because, you know, once you bring aliens into the modern world, that's such a tremendous paradigm shift for everything. Like, that affects everything. It's no longer, Robo's world is not, you know, that takes Robo's world that much further from our own. It becomes less, familiar.
Right.
So in volume one, I think it's issue three, it's the one, there's these mobile pyramids. This ancient, it's a clockwork, water clock, computed and solar powered, 5,000 year old pyramid. And that's not the crazy thing. So they defeat it, you know, it blows up. And in the script, it was supposed to be, problem solved. And I guess we can go back home. And on the last page, like three more of these things were supposed to emerge out of the sand. Like, oh no, you know, what now? And Scott said, Scott figured, oh, that's boring. We just saw a pyramid. So I'm going to make a big monster. Well, yeah, big monsters, you know, is that really the book that we're doing? We don't know yet. So, and that's really the only thing that, you know, we had a little bit of a back and forth on that, but I think that was the biggest one.
Mm-hmm. And I don't remember, was there a big monster in there or just the pyramid?
No, there is a big monster. Okay. He's this bipedal guy, weird cyclopean thing with Egyptian accoutrement and whatever. We solved it, quote unquote. You can't see my air quotes when I'm doing them. In a small story, I think in the next volume or the one after, it's sort of an afterword of, you know, how do they deal with this giant monster? And Jenkins shoots it with a bazooka and it explodes into robot parts. So, you know, was it an ancient robot? Is that less plausible, more plausible than a giant monster? We don't know.
Well, when did you and Scott really hit your stride as a team on the book, do you think?
I think the fans would say volume three, but us, I don't know. We're sort of continually discovering the process. You know, every book that we're doing currently feels like, oh, this is the one, you know, we got it this time.
Mm-hmm.
Then the next one feels like, oh, no, this time for sure. So I don't know. I don't know if maybe that's an ongoing stride. Maybe that's a bunch of different iterative strides.
Well, it seems like when you're working on a project, the one you're working on at the time is always your favorite.
Oh, yeah.
Well, Atomic Robo features a lot of diverse places and times throughout the series, like you mentioned. When you approach a new story, are you choosing these locations based on your interest in them, research, or is it something else?
Sometimes it's research, sometimes it's interest. You know, sometimes unrelated research for another story brings up really interesting facts about a new location or a new era or a new personality from history. Then, you know, we explore that. So it's a combination of both. Like right now, I'm about to start writing volume 11. Volume 10's already been written.
Mm-hmm.
So we've worked fairly far ahead. But volume 11 takes place in 1939, largely in Manchuria. And it's sort of, or the story of this one kind of orbits, is it the second Sino-Russian War? I forget which one. Anyway, a precursor to World War II, there was a bit of an engagement between Russia, China, and Japan. And in the West, we don't really know a lot about it. But over there, or between Russia and Japan, especially, it kind of defined some of their strategies for World War II, because this was where they got to test some of their ground armies and with modernization and tanks and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really pivotal in a way that we just generally in the West aren't aware.
I think I saw this on a recent History Channel special, actually.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's out there and it's interesting stuff, especially
in
the war history. But like, I came across all this on a completely unrelated search for something to do with Volume 10. I was trying to look for a plausible secret location for a secret base, you know, for a plot point in Volume 10. And I came across this whole thing with Manchuria and the Japanese occupation and Korean fleeing and all this other stuff. So that began to form the seed of what Volume 11 would be, because we had, way back in Volume 1, we established that Robo in 1938 has this big adventure in the Himalayas. That's sort of his first big adventure away from home.
Mm-hmm.
And then we on purpose had this sort of blank era of 3 or 4 years where he was just kind of in Asia, Central Asia, and China, just wandering, really, having his own, you know, his, the thing where you're supposed to graduate college and wander Europe for a couple of months. You know, he was doing that, but in the East for a couple of years. And then sort of World War II kind of, or the events leading up to World War II kind of catch up to him, and he, you know, gets involved with all that. So, you know, we've already, narratively, we had him there in that area in 1939, and then I found all this interesting stuff about the war and how it would influence, you know, the rest of well, not the rest, but a great deal of World War II strategy. And it was just a very natural, organic way to kind of tie our character into history, which we always look for. Mm-hmm. You know, we're always much more interested in letting history give us the story and then kind of adding a laser beam to it rather than just inventing stuff from whole cloth.
You're getting me excited about the upcoming storylines.
Good.
Have you always been interested in history and science?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I don't know. It's neat to know things. It's neat to know where we came from culturally and you know, scientifically.
Is it something that you were interested from when you were a child?
Yeah. Yes. That's just, you know, other kids when I was 8 or 9 years old, you know, the other kids were into football and, you know, they had different football heroes and whatever. I liked to watch NOVA, and I was into astrophysics and astronomers and history channels, or not the history channel, didn't have it yet, but, you know, whatever PBS special was on about, I don't know, history.
Well, what's interesting to me about all these unique places in time is that we get to see Robo at various points in his life. Can you talk about what it's like to write an inexperienced Robo versus the seasoned, gutty veteran Robo?
Oh, man, it's a lot of fun. I love young Robo because he's just a little dumb.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, do you have to get in a different kind of a mindset when you're writing him as opposed to the Robo we normally see in the book?
I do, because I feel like, you know, modern-day Robo tracks a little closer to me, where I'm already this sort of cynical, broken, you kids. Yeah, I feel like Krusty the Clown. Like that's my level, you know, as far as whenever people are talking about, oh, yeah, he started at kids, oh, comics, and I'm just like, kid, you don't even know. So yeah, I have to kind of channel, you know, a bright-eyed, optimistic, you know, not yet beaten down by, you know, whatever's going on in the world, and then that's young Robo.
Is it taken from your own experiences?
I guess so. I mean, I had a very sheltered and very pleasant childhood. You know, I lived in a small town, in Florida. My parents were, you know, they had steady jobs, and, you know, we were middle class, very solidly middle class. I got good grades. I mean, it was just, you know, it was a good time. And so I'm a little naive and dumb. Even today, even cynical Brian is naive and dumb. So I just have to kind of emphasize that for Robo as opposed to the grump version of myself.
Mm-hmm. Well, obviously, Robo isn't the only character in the series. You have a pretty colorful cast with all the Tesladyne action scientists like Jenkins. And I also really like Jack Taro, who mentors Robo. And Ooh. You've got Robo's creator, Nikola Tesla. There's a lot of characters who show up in the book. Can you talk about some of the main supporting cast and what they bring to Atomic Robo?
I can sure try. Let's see. Yeah, Jack was a lot of fun. You'll note, although, you know, most people don't realize this, but it becomes obvious once I mention it. There's a lot. Robo has a lot of team ups, right? Because
mm-hmm.
we track them throughout, you know, the world and history. So you obviously can't be hanging out with the same crew because they just fall apart.
Right.
But often we end up teaming Robo up with somebody who really does not get along with him. You know, Jack can't stand him. Even at the end, I think they don't quite get along. Before that, he teams up with the World War II Sparrow, and she hates him.
Right.
You know, Dr. Dinosaur, he's technically had a team up there. They hate each other. I don't know what that is. Maybe that says something terrible about me, but I just love that our main character is someone else's problem, you know, that day. It's just something you don't tend to see, I guess. Mm-hmm. It's usually, you know, somebody fawning over the other. Oh, you know, new character is so cool or whatever. But here it's just, you know, to us, Robo's this cool adventure guy. But to some other adventurer, you know, he's the source of some extra frustration.
Is it jealousy, perhaps, because they're not a robot?
Yeah, who knows? Tesla was a lot of fun, too, because we got to do a little, give the Volume 5 a little more heart there. You know, nice father-son relationship.
Mm-hmm. And what about the action scientists? What do they bring to the book?
I think some commentary, you know, because Robo, especially by the modern day, you know, he has quite literally seen all this stuff before, you know, oh, another mad scientist trying to take over the world or blow up the country. Oh, wow.
Same old, same old.
Yeah, like, is this 1976 again? What's going on? It's so played out. But, you know, to these guys, we sort of straddle a line with the action scientists. On the one hand, it's a very dragnet approach to adventure. And by that, I mean, you know, dragnet, the TV show and the radio show before it, was just, you know, here are the case files. Here's, you know, these cops doing their job. You know, so to those characters going through it, you know, it is just their job, their ordinary job, whatever. They just get the work done. Mm-hmm. They investigate the crime, whatever. So it's that for the action scientists, but to us, you know, it's laser beams and dinosaurs and giant monsters. So to them, they also have a bit of that, you know, well, we've been there and done that, just not really to the degree of Robo, who at this point I think is just getting frustrated with the fact that, you know, there's people out there using their brilliance for selfish ends as opposed to, you know, trying to help out.
Right. Well, you also portray historical figures as characters in the series. We've seen real visionaries like Carl Sagan, H.P. Lovecraft, Thomas Edison, Stephen Hawking's in there too. Why did you want to add real people to Robo?
Well, because real history is really cool, and the real people who made history are, you know, fascinating and amazing. So, you know, we didn't want to do a Forrest Gump sort of thing where, you know, the robot was responsible for all these accomplishments throughout history, mm-hmm. or necessarily there for all these important moments in history. Because we felt that would sort of rob the dignity of, you know, what was actually accomplished by real people, you know, the struggles that they had and the amazing things they came up with and did.
Right.
And so we just like to, you know, kind of nod toward that stuff. You know, it's not a book. Maybe it's starting to sound a little preachy here. I don't know. You know, it is fundamentally just a fun little adventure book. But at the same time, it's not that hard to just go, you know, to sort of highlight really quickly. Oh, you know, this person did amazing things. Read up about them at your local library, you know, and then move on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, have you ever talked with the people you've portrayed in your comics?
No. The closest we got is that I was able to track down Miss Anne, is it Julianne? Julianne? Carl Sagan's widow.
Oh.
Yeah, she co-wrote a bunch of his books. She was a producer with the original Cosmos and the new one. She's in tons of things on her own. Very classy lady. But years ago, because Carl had a fairly big part in one issue, I just, you know, shot an email out into the dark. I said, hey, you know, we're big fans, and I grew up on Cosmos, and Carl's a huge hero of mine, and we did this kind of sci-fi fun comic, and, you know, we just had him as a character. You know, we hope you do not offend. And I was able to send her the Volume 3, the one that has Carl in it the most, and she wrote back sometime later saying, oh, you know, it's very, basically just saying, oh, you know, it's very sweet, you know, you seem to be in the right spirit of things. You're not making fun of Carl and so on. So mm-hmm. She was quite pleased. I think the only stipulation is that she didn't want us kind of relying on Carl's memory or imagery to sell anything, you know, because that would be really cheap and crass. So, you know, we weren't doing that anyway, so mission right. accomplished.
Well, that's pretty cool, actually.
Yeah.
What do you think of the new Cosmos show?
I haven't seen it.
Really?
Yeah, because I don't really watch television. I know it's on Netflix, right?
I don't know. Could be.
Sure it is. But I've seen clips and things, and I think what I've seen is fine. I think it's just that for me, it's it's stuff I already know. So I'm like, well, this is sort of a waste of my time. But then the show isn't for me. You know, I'm a guy who is very engaged in just learning about science. And obviously, as I said earlier, I have been since I could read, basically. Mm-hmm. You know, it's for the same people who, it's for the people like when I was growing up on Cosmos, and I didn't know this stuff yet. You know, sort of gateway into learning more about our world and the universe. And in that sense, I think it's fine. I think it's great.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree with that. It's like a crash course in mm-hmm. science. So that's the reason I don't watch it, because I'm kind of into that myself.
Yeah.
We have to talk about Dr. Dinosaur, who is pretty much everyone's favorite character, a time-traveling super genius who hates mm-hmm. mammals and Robo. So where did the idea for this nemesis come from?
Dr. Dinosaur is, or he comes from, a character I played in a session or two of the Rifts role-playing game. That is from Palladium Books from the early to mid-90s. Mm-hmm. The Palladium games are kind of awful. They're really, the rules are just way too complicated, especially for like the 21st century. But anyway, back then, man, I was all about that stuff. And Rifts in particular is this setting where, dimensional portals have opened up all over the world, and, craziness just pours out. And it's really just an excuse to let all of your different Palladium games, all your different settings, kind of pour into one. And it's this crazy post-apocalyptic fantasy sci-fi mishmash. Mm-hmm. So, of course, a time-traveling mutant dinosaur. It was a game run by some friends of mine where the STF-1 from Robotech.
Oh, I love Robotech.
Oh, hell yes. That was one of the Palladium games. That's what got me into it. Anyway, the STF-1 has crashed on Earth, and we are trying to explore it. Palladium also had the license for Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Now, one of these books was called Transdimensional TMNT, where it had rules for time travel and traveling through different dimensions and making dinosaurs who were intelligent. So I had an intelligent raptor who was a time-traveling interdimensional scientist who wanted to... he was the only guy, basically, who had the skills to figure out how to activate the STF-1. But he was also the one who wanted to use it to conquer Earth and destroy all the mammals.
Of course.
Yeah, which are, and, all the other guys, they were not into that plan. So, but anyway, it made for a fun game, a fun character that kind of stuck in my mind. And so, why not throw that at Atomic Robo?
Wow. And when did you create this again, this character for the game?
2003 or 4. It was a while ago.
Wow, that is a while
ago. And it's funny because... I pitched that to Scott. He was like, no, that's too crazy. Nobody's going to like that. That's dumb. And so after a couple of years, I finally convinced him to, do a Dr. Dinosaur story for just a really quick, like 8 pages, free comic book day. If it bombs, nobody's going to remember. And of course, it was, our most popular story to date.
Right. And why do you think that is? Why do you think Dr. Dinosaur is such a great antagonist to Robo?
Because he's, to me, it's because, all right, I assume you watched, Warner Brothers cartoons back when you were a kid, Looney Tunes and Merry Melodies. My favorite ones were, first of all, anything with Daffy. But second, my favorite Bugs Bunny ones were the ones with Cecil Turtle.
Okay.
Because those are the only ones where Bugs lost. It was this wonderful inversion of the Bugs formula. So that's what Dr. Dinosaur is. For us, he's the Cecil Turtle. He's the one who, no matter how crazy he is, no matter how wrong he is, no matter how much Robo defeats him, Robo still loses in the end.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So that's the function of Dr. Dinosaur. It's just satisfying to watch him invert and subvert the rules that we've already established in the setting. And then plus he's just, spouting nonsense the whole time. Who doesn't love that?
Oh, I love it. It must be hard not to put him in every arc.
No, actually, it's easy to not put him in because he's so difficult to write. I should explain that. He's not actually difficult to write. He's too easy to write mm-hmm. because literally anything he says or does makes perfect sense for him to say or do, and that can really derail any actual plan. So yeah, one in eight was a hell of a thing to try to write because you had a lot of page time. Oof.
Well, let's talk about publishing and marketing.
Sure.
You and Scott got together and started creating the book. When did you first start pitching it to comic book companies? Did you finish an issue of the book or a few pages first?
Yeah, we had no idea what we were doing. So we figured, well, we're going to just start working on the first volume of the and then pitch it. I think we had the whole first issue done, and we started sending it out to publishers. It wasn't colored yet, but you know, we had the inks done. And we started this in the summer of 2006.
Mm-hmm.
I think by fall Red 5 had picked us up, but they weren't ready to order it by winter. But they didn't want to publish until the following fall, so it wasn't until October 2007 that our first issue came out. And by that time, we'd already finished the whole first volume.
Was Red 5 the only company that was interested in it? How did you ultimately choose to go with them?
Yeah, they were the ones who showed interest. Everyone else either said nothing or they rejected us.
Wow. And what were the early days of working with Red 5 like? How much input did they have initially on the series?
I had none, really. They didn't want to have much input. They wanted it to maintain a PG-13-ish vibe. You know, they didn't want anything gory or, you know, explicit. But that was already our mission plan anyway.
Mm-hmm.
That was it.
And is that it's remained that way, I assume?
Oh, yeah. They want us to do our own thing.
Okay. So Atomic Robo is a series of miniseries, but it's unique in that new readers can pick up any volume to get started. Now, you don't need to read the series in order of publication. Obviously, this is something that you intended, but does it ever get hard for you to write the book this way to ensure that each arc is new reader friendly?
No. And I would argue some folks say that, you know, we've lost that a bit with the current volume, mm-hmm. Volume 9, because it is such a diversion from what we usually do, and it is very tightly tied in with Volume 8. But I figure, you know, you can accomplish a lot in the first page to get people on board. And I think the basic premise of Atomic Robo helps kind of pave over any sort of unfamiliarity. You know, you see on the cover, it's this robot, right? So you're already ready to accept that he could be any number of years old. You know, he could be 10 years old. He could be 100 years old.
Right.
You're already willing to accept that he's super strong, he's super invulnerable, and you don't need to ask why. You know, you just accept it because you see a robot. And it's, okay, well, then of course, he can lift a car, he can walk through a wall, whatever.
Right.
You know, so just having that sort of freedom, that knowledge that as soon as you see on the page, this robot, the reader is already on board with a great deal of things they aren't even consciously aware of yet, you can kind of manipulate that and catch them up to where they need to be within just a few lines of dialogue that aren't exposition-y, you know, it's an actual conversation. And we sort of trust our readers to... I don't want to say be intelligent because that sounds like we're denigrating people who don't read our stuff, but we don't do a lot. We don't do any handholding. We just say, you know, here's the book, mm-hmm. here's the adventure. You know, you're on board. Either they will miss out. They will definitely miss out on a few things. Even in volume one, you're going to miss out on a few things because we were planting seeds that wouldn't pay off until much later.
Right.
But it's all there in a way where it's not front and center in, like, let's say a Marvel or DC book where if you miss, you know, one of the issues in the crossover, you don't know what's going on. I thought he was dead, you know. I thought he was a man, you know, whatever. But with Robo, these things are just sort of incidental. They're just in the background. It lets you read whatever book it is and just enjoy the adventure for what it is. And ideally, the reader has enjoyed it enough that they want to find out more and they'll buy, you know, the rest of the series or just, you know, the next one or whatever. And they'll start building their own context. You'll start seeing, oh, that ties into this. Oh, that this means this other thing. Oh, that's a reference to this other story. Oh, okay. But initially, on the initial read-through, it should just be, you know, here's a fun adventure.
Well, it's really interesting that you mentioned that, you know, you just look at Robo and you can tell what he is. I mean, mm-hmm. obviously, I see that, but never really thought about it. Is that why he doesn't have an origin story? Because...
Yeah. And in fact, we often, especially at a show where it's we speak to a lot of people who aren't familiar with the book, and they'll say, "Oh, well, which one's got the origin story?" And I'm like, you know, I'll just point at, you know, random cover. I'm like, he's a robot. And he got built. Done. That's the origin story. That's not a, you know, that's not fun. That's uninteresting. You know, it's why Volume 5 is the closest we've done to the origin story, because he's already been built. He's already been around.
Mm-hmm.
But it's his first big adventure. Now it gets interesting. You know, now it's the adventure. Now it's not just Tesla in secret, you know, working in a lab for 10 years or whatever it is.
Right. Yeah, that's great. I mean, it's, the interesting part is not how he came to be, but what he does afterwards.
Exactly. You know, so much of what we've done with the book was sort of a reaction to what we felt were structural problems with American comics storytelling. You know, there's a lot of cruft. There's a lot of grimdark for the sake of looking mature but not being mature. There's a lot of continuity you got to keep up with, and then alternate continuity you have to sift out, and all this other stuff. You know, the whole point of Atomic Robo, well, you also have to explain, you know, how has Superman been around for 100 years? Oh, we'll do another reboot. You know, Robo is a robot, so he can be around for as long as he needs to be. You don't have to give a weird explanation for his powers, because it already makes sense, because he's just a robot. You know, it's all this stuff that, you know, again, like I said, as soon as you open it up, you immediately understand this stuff without having to think about it, and we can just jump straight into having fun.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've been looking at the website for Atomic Robo, and I think it's really great. It's easy to navigate. It includes a blog, you know, links to free comics, a timeline. You even have a Google map on there that gives you a visual guide to where our Robo's adventures have taken place. What did you want to achieve with that site when you built it?
All that stuff. partly, you know, it's funny, because the timeline especially is there primarily for me, because there's a lot going on in Robo's world, and, you know, it gets hard to remember, you know, when was he or where was he when, you know, et cetera. So I would go back to the timeline like, all right, this, he was, you know, in 1949, he should have been over here. Okay, that makes sense. And then move forward. And it's funny because, you know, we just published the role-playing game earlier this summer, and it does a lot of things, but there's it expands on the timeline and fills in some extra gaps, and it gives a brief bio on a ton of characters. Basically, if a character has had a name in the book, you know, he's got a bio and he's got some stats and so on.
Yeah, I'm actually going to go and buy that today.
Good, you should. It's an amazingly well put together book. The whole team involved over at Evil Hat involved in it did an amazing job. But, you know, I'm all just the other night, I had to work out the RPG and refer to it to find, you know, to get some background on one of the action scientists, because I couldn't remember, oh, did he study this or did he study that? Oh, there it is, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that timeline's pretty detailed. It was just an interesting read just to see everything he's done and where he's been. I was surprised, even having read, you know, all the volumes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the other thing on your website that really stands out is the pledge. And you kind of touched on this earlier when you said that Robo was a response to the way comics were being put out. But the pledge vows that Robo will have no angst, no cheesecake, no reboots, no filler, and Robo will always punch another robot or monster. Can you talk about why you created that pledge and what it means to you?
Sure. Well, it had a bit more impact in 2006 or 2007 when we first started publishing. Certainly this was not at the nadir of American comics. I think it would be more in somewhere in the 90s. But even in 2006 and 2007, there was a certain tendency, especially among certain lines of comics, to, you know, be ripping off arms and heads and a bunch of gore and, you know, weird sexist stuff. And there's still some of that around, but there's definitely been... I'm proud to say that Robo is one of the first books to sort of intentionally and audibly and visibly push back and say, no, let's just calm down on that stuff. Let's just have some fun. And there's certainly been, you know, since we started coming out, not that we, just to make sure I'm not like trying to posit that we began all this. It's something that's been in the zeitgeist for a while. We just happened to be, you know, a book there that was in the early 2000s wave of it. You know, pushing back, and especially at Marvel these days, they're doing some really great stuff as far as being more inclusive and trying to reduce some of their sexism. That's just sort of inherent in the history of the comics industry, both as creators and as a visual medium. You know, just male gaze is everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, in 2006, this was a slightly more radical position to take and to be so vocal about it. Other people were as well, but I don't know. You didn't see it as often back then. And I don't know. It's just something that was important to us. You know, we were tired of things, seeing things. You know, every time you see a shot in a comic book from the point of view of a girl's ass or her breasts, it's like, all right, I get it. I know.
Right.
You know, this again, you know, really? This is what you think of us as an audience, that we need to see this to buy your book? Why don't you make just a good book? And, you know, we'll go from there on the book's own merits.
Right. And I mean, you've succeeded with that. And I was looking at the pledge and I'm thinking, man, have they ever messed up and done something that didn't adhere to the pledge? And I can't think of anything, but is there anything?
I would say, and I forget the guy's name, but he sent us an email saying, hey, it's at the bottom of the pledge. You know, there's a link that goes back to our, it's a contact link and says, hey, I forget the exact wording, but, you know, we're going to mess up. You know, call us out if we do, and, you know, contact us. And somebody did, and he mentioned that he felt that that we have underrepresented historical women. And I would say that's true.
Huh, that, I guess that is true.
Yeah, it flew under my radar in Scott's because we had, back in Volume 2, we had the World War II Sparrow, who was a lady super spy, and folks really loved her. And then more recently in Volume 7, we had the Flying She-Devils. You know, this team of all women aviators who, after the war, say, you know, we're going to stay out here and we're going to have adventures. We're not going back home.
Yeah, I love that one.
Yeah, and that had a huge response. You know, people did love that. But these are all fictional characters. These are not historical women characters. So that's something that I'm trying to work. You know, there's been a, and as a personal, you know, just fan of history and learning about history, you inevitably learn about the constant rewriting of history to erase women's accomplishments. Even if, I mean, and we maybe, you know, you hear that and you think, oh, you know, we don't do that anymore. It's all throughout the 20th century. You know, it's still happening. So we want to find adventure stories that have Robo where we can kind of, I don't know, undo some of that.
It's true. They get marginalized. I just listened to an NPR podcast about the internet.
Was it the... was it the programmers or?
Exactly, the programmers, and they were almost all women because the men didn't feel like that was an important job to do, and it ended up being the most important part of creating computers.
When you hear the word computer, you just think of a machine. It's called a computer because that was the job of, it was an actual person called a computer, and it was like 80-90% women. Yeah. And here we are today, and you know they're being pushed out of the tech industry at all levels, and it's like, you know, this was, I mean, from Ada Lovelace forward, computing was a heavily woman-involved, if not nearly dominated field, up until, you know, just our generation, basically.
Yeah, I mean, it was shocking to me, and then, you know, I felt like it shouldn't be shocking to me, you know? That's something I should know.
Yeah, yeah. It's just, oh, this again, you know.
Yeah, they just don't cover enough. But, you know, maybe that's something you can work in a robo. It seems like that might fit somehow.
Oh, yeah, yeah. We're into... because I mean, we have a connection to Bletchley Park in the story already, and I'll just say yes.
Cool. Well, I personally read Robo on Comixology, and I heard that it was actually the first book that was uploaded to the site, and I was wondering what... it is true. Oh, good. Yeah. So what are your thoughts on that and on delivering Robo to your readers in digital form these days?
I think, well, with Comixology being the very first book in their database, that was just a bit of a lucky coincidence. The guys at Red 5 were very pro, you know, digital distribution. It's something that the big publishers were afraid of because, of course, they had the most to risk, you know, back in whatever this was, 2006 and 2007. New publishers like Red 5, especially back then, you know, we were their first book in 2007. Basically, I have nothing to risk. You know, it's just, oh, you know, people can get our books in a different way. Great. So they absolutely chased down the sort of emerging, the bubbling digital distribution networks from back in the day. And, you know, got involved with Comixology at the absolute ground floor. And we because our book, I think, was alphabetically the first one. You know, it got alphabetically first. But yeah, we love basically any way you can get our comics. Like even at shows, you know, if somebody's like really kind of they're into it, they just don't happen to have the money, you know, because you know, these shows that, you know, conventions are extremely expensive just to attend, much less buy, you know, what you want.
Mm-hmm.
I'll say, you know, okay, here's our card. You know, go just go to Comixology later. You get them at like half price, or, you know, get them at Amazon. They're going to be three quarters price, basically. You know, just get them somehow, any way that you can. I don't even care, and I shouldn't say this, I don't care if you pirate them. Because I know, I believe very, you know, intensely in our product. If you, in whatever way you get them, even if it's pirating, you're going to read them, and you go, oh, I hate this, this sucks, and then, you know, they're never going to buy it anyway. Or you're going to be, man, I got to get more of this. I got to, I've read it all, I pirated it all, but I got to do something to support these guys. I want to see more of this stuff. I'm going to buy something. Mm-hmm. I don't care if they buy them all, if they get them all. If they get just one book, you know, a Comixology or whatever, you know, it'll filter through. The support will come through.
Any gateway that works.
Yeah, I mean, that's the big problem with the decline of comics. You know, it historically has been popular to blame video games or movies or, you know, cable or the internet or whatever. But really, it's been the decades-long death of the distribution network of comics. You can't get them anywhere.
Right.
You know, there's whole towns. They don't have a single comic shop. There's less than 2,000 comic shops in the U.S. Think about that.
Yeah.
This is a country of 300 million people.
And most of them are in the big cities, too.
Right. You know, there's some cities that have 5 or 7, you know.
I'm in Chicago, and Graham Crackers Comics alone has, like, 11 locations.
There you go. Right? So you got to figure there must be whole, you know, 1,000 miles where there's no comic shop.
Mm-hmm.
You know? How are any of those people supposed to buy one? So yes, absolutely, digital distribution or anything that helps, you know, get the word out, online sales, whatever.
And you have a lot of free RoboComics on Comixology. There's got to be at least 7 or 8 free ones.
Yeah, we put up all of our free comic book days and a few of the little bonus stories, little 4-page stories.
Mm-hmm. And I love Comixology too because comics are so expensive these days and there's so many deals on there and most publishers drop their prices after a month. I find myself trying way more books than I have in previous years because of that.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Well, for the 2013 Emerald City Comic Con, you guys created an exclusive digital comic for Comixology called Atomic Robo Two-Fisted Tales, Along Came a Tarantula, that used the guided view system. I was wondering what was it like to create that?
That was nuts. That was a purely digital comic. We had no plans to ever print that one. I don't know how we could really because there are no real pages. Like, every single panel is a construction of several distinct images, and they don't really align with pages. But anyway, we had a lot of fun. You know, it was very experimental. We'd never made a comic like that, you know, intentionally made for that guided view, that sort of extra level of not quite animated, but not quite static either. Yeah, we had a lot of fun with that one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought it was a really cool use of the technology. I love that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, let's talk a little bit about the RPG. You mentioned it, and like I said, I'm gonna go out and buy the book today because when I was doing research, I found it. I didn't know it existed.
Where have you been?
I don't know, under a rock, man. My friends and I, we were interested in starting up a D&D group, and mm-hmm. so we were going to do that, but we're going to do it over the internet. And it's just hard to... the rules are just... a lot of rules in it. And so when I found this Atomic Robo and it has this system where it's supposed to be easier to get into, I was like, maybe we'll try that. So can you talk about the gameplay? What is the game like?
Sure. One thing I'll mention is that, it uses the Fate system from Evil Hat Productions.
Right.
The Fate system is interesting. I've noticed that old school role players, you know, guys who grew up on D&D and so on, have trouble grappling with it because it is such a fundamentally different approach to how rules work and how a game should be played and made. But you sound like you're new to the whole experience.
I've never played the Fate system. I used to play D&D when I was younger.
Okay. Well, then maybe there's enough space there for you to kind of hop onto this new, I don't know, system.
Mm-hmm.
One way I describe it to people is that in games like D&D, and this isn't anything against them, I've played them all my life and I love them, but games like D&D, you roll the dice and that tells you what happens, right?
Mm-hmm.
Fate, you roll the dice and that's the beginning of a conversation about what will happen.
Ah, gotcha.
Yeah, it's a subtle shift, but it's important. With that approach, you find that the DM is not so powerful. There's a lot of narrative power given to the players, and it becomes a very cooperative thing, cooperative with the players, and then the players as a group with the GM. It's a very different approach.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot of fun. I have listened to people play the game on podcasts, and there'll be people who have no familiarity with Atomic Robo, but they're aware enough of Fate to kind of, you know, just jump into it and roll. And you can barely listen to these podcasts because they're laughing so much, because the way that our game has structured Fate, you know, to sort of interact with the fiction of Atomic Robo's world, it just very easily emulates the sort of fun that you have with an Atomic Robo comic, but without having to sit down and grind out all the details. It sort of just happens as you go.
Right.
Part of that is our character creation system. You can make a character in about 1 minute or less.
Wow.
There's two ways to do it. You can either do it the super quick way, where it's just you start with an overall concept, like, you know, a certain kind of action scientist, demolitions is my kind of science. You know, that's your sentence. You know, you can start with that, and then through the act of play, you can kind of retroactively figure out your skills and your different abilities and so on as you play. It's a very fun way to discover and to create a character. Alternatively, you can do the more traditional way where you figure out all the math and all the powers. You know, maybe you have a more focused idea of what you want your character to be. So you can, you know, do that. And, you know, that takes whatever it takes, 20 minutes, 10 minutes, I don't know. Depends on your system mastery, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, we introduced in this game, thanks to Mike Olson, the game designer behind Atomic Robo's RPG, the brainstorm system, which is that thing in every sci-fi show and in Atomic Robo where the scientists, you know, brainiac up a solution to a problem.
Mm-hmm.
We've done this in a way where it's this cooperative but also slightly competitive impromptu thing where the players get to determine what's happening. There's no way to they're never wrong, basically. A brainstorm always turns out to be correct, which can lead to some really fun, really crazy adventures. It also means that the GM himself or herself doesn't have to know everything. You can start an adventure with like the barest minimum amount of preparation, and the players will the players will supply ideas, and then you can kind of determine just how true those ideas are going to be. I'm babbling at this point, but I'm a huge fan of Fate over the last few years,
mm-hmm.
even before we started working the RPG. What I like is that it is a system that so consistently delivers, there's like this feedback between players and the GM and the players themselves of constantly signaling what it is the player wants to do to have fun, and then rewarding them for doing it, and then also making failure interesting and fun for everyone at the table.
This game sounds great.
Yeah, so it's a lot of fun, yeah.
How many times have you played it yourself?
Now, that is really funny. I have only played the Atomic Robo RPG a couple times, and I will tell you why. It took us a while, Scott and I, it took us a while to figure out why that is. We kind of don't like playing the Robo game.
Why?
Because to us, it feels like work.
Ah, interesting.
And it's, moreover, it's work we're not getting paid for.
Because you'd rather spend your time just working on new Robo stuff.
Right, like, yeah, like, you know, we'd be making these characters, we'd be playing this game, huh. And we're just looking at each other like, man, this would make it really fun. Why aren't we doing this pretty complicated? We need to stop playing this game. We need to get back to work.
That makes sense.
Yeah. But I feel like that's a big endorsement of the game, weirdly enough, because it so easily simulates what it's like to read Atomic Robo. It even simulates what it's like to write and to create Atomic Robo.
See, that's what's great to hear, because the comic is so much fun. I really enjoy reading it, and to simulate that experience through gameplay must be really gratifying for you.
Yeah, the Mike Olson's brainstorm rules are just amazing for that. You know, you don't even, like, we can do it in the comic because we're, Scott and I are both sci-fi nerds, science nerds, and history nerds, so we can kind of weave these complicated, you know, conspiracy webs together, and, you know, boom, you know, there's an interesting story. We don't expect all players to have our lifelong encyclopedic, you know, obsession with these things, and you don't need them. Just the way that the brainstorm works, just you things just happen. You'll see.
Mm-hmm. Now, how did the game come about? Did you approach Mike at Evil Hat to do the game, or was it something that he came to you with?
No, I had just recently bought the Fate edition of Kerberos Club, which is essentially League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, the role-playing game.
Okay.
That's not quite doing it justice, but that'll get you the idea. Anyway, Mike wrote the Fate edition of that game. It had originally been, I forget what it was. He's going to hit me for that. But anyway, so I was reading the rules, and, you know, it allowed for a wide spectrum of power levels, which you absolutely see in Atomic Robo. It also allowed for a great deal of customization. So you can make, you know, Atomic Robo as a character in Kerberos Club, and all the way down to, you know, Bernard the Action Scientist who can't do anything. And then at the same time, the rules were actually written in a really fun, entertaining, kind of light and snappy way. You know, role-playing game rules can be, you know, sort of dreary, you know, it can be like reading a contract. Like, it's just overly complicated, overly dry. But this had a nice little zip to it. So it's like, you know, this guy sounds like he could do Atomic Robo. So I contacted him, and he was like, what the hell's Atomic Robo? So I sent him...
He had no clue.
He had no clue, never even heard of it. So I sent him, which, you know, doesn't offend me. We're a small comic book.
Right.
I assume most people haven't heard of us.
Mm-hmm.
But so I sent him some PDFs, and he says he got through one page, and he's like, yes, I'm in. Let's do it.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
So, yeah, and he has since become, like, the biggest Robo fanboy. He's like, I don't know where this has been my whole life, but, you know, he loves it.
That's kind of how I felt when I started reading it.
Yeah. So then we were just going to do it sort of independently. But then on Twitter, I kind of came across the notice of Fred Hicks. He's the guy who owns and runs Evil Hat Productions, who make the Fate system. Because I was all reading just some other Fate books and just talking about them on Twitter. And Fred came across this. He was like, oh, hey, we're big fans of Atomic Robo over here at Evil Hat. So I said, we need to take this to email, sir. And I said, hey, we want to make a... You know, we've always wanted to make an Atomic Robo role-playing game. It's something that Scott and I had talked about before we talked about what Volume 2 would be. So, and I said, we're doing, you know, I'm talking with this Mike Olson guy. I'm trying to do a Fate system. You know, do you guys want in on that? And he was like, oh, you know, I've been looking for an excuse to work with Mike for a while. And we like Atomic Robo, so, you know, let's do it.
Wow, it all fell into place.
Yeah.
That's great. All right, well, I want to shift gears a little bit and talk about your writing career. You started off creating the webcomic 8-Bit Theater, which is a humorous take on Final Fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
But what was it like for you to make the transition from webcomics to comic books?
I was pretty painless. I think the main thing was that there's a lot more structure in print comics because you have whatever it is, 20 pages, 22 pages, 24 pages. And that's your issue. And you, whatever it is you're doing, you got to get it done, you know, within that scope. Whereas with 8-Bit Theater, you know, you'll look at that thing and there's 1,200 pages in there. Well, really, you probably could have gotten done it about 300. But, you know, there was no real structure, so I just kind of wandered and just did whatever I thought was funny or interesting that day.
Mm-hmm.
But with print, I mean, you got deadlines and you got page count and, you know, you got to figure out how to make it happen. Within those constraints.
So with Atomic Robo, you and Scott have received a lot of acclaim, and you've gotten on the Big Two's radar, and you even worked for Marvel briefly writing Captain America: The Fighting Avenger.
All too briefly.
Right, because it was originally supposed to be a series, and it got canceled.
Yep, canceled before it came out.
Right, and the same thing happened to you with DC's Firestorm series, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So I was wondering what you took away from those experiences and how it affected the way you look at creator-owned work versus work for hire.
You cannot depend on, you know what it is. I learned that it is idiotic to give power of, you know, give my life over to corporate interests. You know, Marvel and DC, they take a great deal of care with a few creators, and those guys and gals are very lucky. Mm-hmm. The rest of us, we got to pay the bills somehow. And if you're just, you know, if that's not you, then, you know, you're kind of relying on yourself. I chased Marvel and DC work for a while, and just nothing was coming of it, and I figured, you know what, this is just making me miserable, and I prefer to work on my own stuff anyway. You know, I'm just looking to pay the bills with the freelance stuff. Why don't I double down on Robo and see how that goes? And it was just instantly better. Just, you know, a weight off my shoulders and never look back.
So you're not going to actively pursue that any longer then?
No, I mean, I haven't in years.
Hmm. Well, I like Robo better anyways than the big two Marvel or DC books.
Yeah, and I mean...
And you get to do whatever you want, man.
Exactly. I mean, I don't want it to sound like sour grapes, because I honestly feel that Marvel especially has just a great concentration of talent, both as creators and on editorial. And this isn't me covering my ass in the hopes that I get hired or whatever, because I don't care. I don't plan to get hired. Probably would turn down any such work. But honestly, they're putting out some of the best stuff they've done in ages. But, you know, you don't control your own destiny on stuff like that as a creator. You know, ultimately, you're answering to somebody who doesn't care about comics, you know, an accountant somewhere along the line really has the final say. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'd rather just, I'm not a good employee, period. I used to work at a comic book store. And I got fired, they say, because of, you know, the economic explosion that happened that month. But I think I was like, oh, because I was just a crappy employee. I just, you know, just leave me alone. Let me do my thing. And fun comic books will come out.
Yeah, too much of the yell at the kids in the lawn mentality still, huh?
Yeah, it is. You know, you know, I'm guilty of it. You know, it is my own fault. It's because I came up through Ape Theater for 10 years. Well, I didn't have to answer to anybody. So I just got used to being in this mindset of, not that I'm always right or whatever, but just if I detect some bullshit, I'm just going to call it for what it is. I'm not going to mince any words there. And
well, you never got a... Well, this is what I read. I don't know for sure, but you never got a reason for why they took you off of Firestorm. Is that correct?
It took a while to eke out the reason.
Really?
Because what they told me just did not make any sense. Didn't align with anything they had told me previously. So I knew somewhere along the line, you know, a falsehood was being passed along, either to the editors or from the editors to me. And I realized what it was, because the book that I was doing was supposed to debut, I think it was September 2010,
mm-hmm.
or 2011, I forget which. And what happened that year in September was the New 52 launch. Uh-huh. And if you backtrack from there, you know, it takes a certain amount of time to solicit, to plan, to make these books and to draw them and to write them, etc. That's right when I got hired, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think like a week later, somebody at WB or whatever said, oh my god, you guys have got to do something about our flagging sales, we're going to make this new 52 happen, and chomping on a fat cat cigar this whole time. and so I kind of got lost in that shuffle. But at the time, they couldn't tell me because New 52 was super top secret up until it was announced, I don't know, whenever, a month later.
Yeah, but they still replaced you with somebody else. They could have had you write for New 52 instead, and they didn't bother you.
Sort of, yeah, sort of, no, because what they wanted me to do was very tightly tied in with previous continuity, which just wasn't a factor anymore once New 52 was decided upon.
Well, I'm really sad that you didn't get to do more of the Captain America, because it seems like that was really in your wheelhouse.
Oh, yeah, that was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Had a great deal of fun with that.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Real Science Adventures. I wanted to touch on that because it's an anthology spinoff series that you write, but there's different artists on it. How did this second series come about?
Well, Scott and I keep you know, over the years, we make these books and we find secondary characters that we really like, or come up with little ideas that just don't fit anywhere else. You know, they won't make up a whole issue, or it makes no sense to include it as a backup story somewhere else or whatever. So we thought, okay, well, you know, we should just have a whole little miniseries of these things, just this place where, you know, the hardcore fans who would be interested in these extra bits of continuity, you know, they can pick it up and have fun and enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
As well, especially in our early days, we were just getting flooded with requests from artist friends of ours and fans. We're like, you know, man, I would just love to work with you guys, you know, even if it's just a little 4-page thing. So that's actually why we made a bunch of the, if you collected the early comic books and trades, there's a lot of these little 4 and 6 page little short stories. So, you know, because we figured, oh, yeah, you know, I'll write up a quick little thing and you can draw it and we'll put it in an issue. It'd be a lot of fun. But over the years, we started realizing, you know, we're kind of exploiting these guys. We weren't paying them.
Oh.
You know, because they came to us just begging, you know, oh, I don't care. I just want to work on Atomic Robo. He looks like he'd be fun to draw.
Right.
But after a few years, we were like, yeah, we should really be paying these guys. It's just not fair. And another thing, I mean, even the fairness aside, you know, if they're doing free work and it's on a deadline, you have no pull there. They're just, you know, what are you going to do, not pay me if I don't make it? You know, it was interfering with our publishing schedule, or it certainly threatened to. So it just behooved everybody to start paying them to make these things. And so it was easier to pitch it to Red 5 as, hey, what if we do this whole other series that you can sell as well as Atomic Robo? Oh, but by the way, we got to pay these artists to do it. And they're like, oh, yeah, of course you got to pay the artist. So, you know, that's how that came about.
Mm-hmm. Now, how is Robo and Real Science Adventures selling? Is it doing well for you guys?
Yeah. People seem to enjoy it. I thought they wouldn't sell very well. Just because, you know, Real Science Adventures is essentially targeting a niche of a niche. You know, it's people who like Robo enough to buy yet more, you know, more than just the, you know, the standard book. But it seems to be selling really well. I know most of my, anecdotally, my experience with sales is at comic book conventions where we have a copy of, you know, we have copies of everything, and Real Science Adventures sells out just like everything else.
Right.
So.
All right. Well, I'm in the last section now. Man, I have a lot of questions for you.
I don't mind talking.
Oh, great. So you and Scott have been rocking out Robo for a while now. Does it ever sink in that you've created a franchise? You're on volume 9 of the series. You have an anthology spinoff that we just talked about. There's an RPG. There was an animated short called Last Stop. There's so much going on with the book. Do you ever reflect back on it, and does it ever sink in that this is a franchise that you've created?
Yeah, I really do not think of it as a franchise. I think Scott and I are so neck deep in whatever, you know, current volume, whatever volume is current to us, that we're just mostly concentrated on that. I still find it bizarre. I try not to think about it, to be honest, that we've already done 1,000 pages.
Yeah.
That just seems insane to me. So I try not to think about it.
And how long do you guys plan to work on Robo? How many volumes are planned?
See, that's a tough question. Right now we have plans of varying degrees of specificity up to, I think it's volume 22 or 23.
Wow.
Which is not to say that would even be the last volume, because that's many years worth of content, and I'm sure that within that time we'll have thought of, you know, yet more stuff to throw.
I mean, you're only halfway through now.
Yeah, not even, really.
No.
And that doesn't include new Real Science Adventures anthologies.
So you don't have a planned ending in mind for Robo then?
Not really. I'm sure we'll reach a point where we feel like, you know, we've had enough. Or
you die.
Or we die. The closest thing that I don't have a planned ending, but I do have like a planned note that I'd like to end on, which would just basically be that there's, you know, this is just a last story that we're showing, but obviously there's going to be so much more, and Robo is just, I don't know, there's always going to be another adventure. We would want to end on a very optimistic note, because we feel that the book has kind of always had that to it.
Mm-hmm.
And we would just want to not take that away.
I just thought of something ridiculous. You should end on him getting a pair of indestructible pants.
Well, the pants are hardly ever ruined.
I know. That's true.
You should patent those things.
So are there any plans to move Robo to other mediums? I mentioned the Last Stop animated film. It's on YouTube, but is there any new developments in TV or film or animation?
Everybody in comics is talking to somebody in Hollywood, but I would not say that is a plan. If a movie or TV show happens, that's great. But really, Scott and I are mostly concerned with just making the best comic that we can. Mm-hmm.
Now, is that something, if it did happen, is it something you would want some control over, or are you more of the school, like, here's the property, you can do what you want with it?
Well, with RPG, I ended up writing a lot. So I don't know. I think it would depend on who was behind it.
Mm-hmm. If you trusted them or not to do
it. If I trusted them. We've talked to some people. It was really frustrating. We've talked to several people in Hollywood. And the first bunch were, oh, man, this was way back in the day. I think it was Volume 3 had just come out. And they were like, wow, we love this new Atomic Robo, and, we love everything you're doing with it because it's so different from everything else that's out there. Now, here's how we're going to change everything to make it exactly like everything else so we can make a movie out of it. Didn't like that so much. That was not a fun experience.
No.
So yeah, it would absolutely depend upon how trustworthy the other party could be.
Mm-hmm. Well, as we mentioned before, you can pretty much pick up any volume of Robo and not have to worry too much about the continuity. But is there one volume that you'd recommend over the others as the place to start, or as perhaps the best representation of your writing on the series?
I like to start people with 3 or 5. And I usually play it by, how they react to them. Volume 5 is, as I mentioned earlier, the earliest adventure of Atomic Robo that we've published.
Mm-hmm.
So it's got Young Robo, it's his first big adventure. That one's got Tesla, Edison, robots, gangsters, romance, action, 1930s pulp, the War of the Currents. I mean, it's a lot of fun. There's a lot going on in that.
Mm-hmm.
Volume 3 I also like to recommend because it is in... It's one volume that sort of is the structure of all the volumes. It's these unrelated stories that are kind of tied together, and at the end, you see how it all is a one big story. So, Volume 3 or Volume 5, you can't go wrong.
Well, the current Robo series is Knights of the Golden Circle. For people interested in jumping on the book, can you talk about what that story is about?
Sure. How can I say it without a spoiler? It doesn't matter. So science in Robo's world is a lot like ours, except it's a little bit more explosive and a little stranger. And what with one thing and another, Robo was transported back to, I think it's 1872. Volume 9 opens in 1884, so he's been there for over a decade. And it's sort of the story of how Robo saved the West without knowing that he did it. There's a threat to basically the world, but beginning with a threat to the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And he just happens to come across it, and I hope he thwarts it. Maybe there's one more issue to go.
Great. All right, so I got a couple more questions. You created an employee handbook for Tesla Dyne on Kickstarter. It's a collection of practical advice and procedures for all kinds of sci-fi situations that you will never encounter. Mm-hmm. I have not seen the book, but I was wondering if you could give me some advice from it.
Yeah. Oh, here's interesting. We have one chapter called, Are You Living Inside a Simulation? okay, so it starts off, the short answer, yes, but that's okay. The long answer is a tough one, psychologically anyway. The concept is simple enough, but its ramifications go deep into some bizarre territory. The basic idea, and this I'm not quoting from it anymore, is that, in this chapter anyway, the basic idea is that computing power is going to continue to increase, and it will, assuming that the end of the world doesn't happen,
mm-hmm.
it'll reach a point where it'll become practical to run a simulation of a universe. Now, once you have that, it's not that difficult to run more than one. Okay, because you can just build another computer to do it.
Right.
Okay, so if you have one simulation of the universe running, the odds that you are living in the real universe is 50%. But the more copies of the simulation you have, the less and less and less and less likely it is that you live in the true real universe. It becomes infinitely more likely that you are a simulation in a quantum computer in some other universe.
Wow.
Moreover, it becomes increasingly likely that humans aren't even running the simulation, that it's some kind of alien running, you know, a million of these simulations in their own universe just to look at, you know, what different constants of different values would have on the universe. Mm-hmm. The actual real universe may have no bearing whatsoever to the one that you know in your simulation. You might not even ever have been a real actual Earth.
You're blowing my mind here, Brian.
This is all legitimate stuff.
Yeah, I can see.
Seriously, it is. It's simulation theory. It's a real bizarre unintended complication of computability, basically. So yeah, the field guide is full of these just strange things and how to deal with them. There's a whole chapter on how to deal with your evil twin from another universe. How to first be sure that it's an evil twin from another universe and not merely a clone who's evil.
That sounds fantastic.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun.
All right, so the final question I have is, if you could pit Atomic Robo against any robot or monster from literature, comics, or film, what would it be and why?
Man, we do that all the time.
That's true. But how about one that you haven't done?
Well, I'll say that Volume 10, and I keep calling it this, and nobody's going to really get to the degree to which it makes sense. Volume 10, the next one that's coming up at you, is essentially Jason Bourne meets Pacific Rim, the fanfic.
Wow.
Yeah, that is a weird combination, but we pulled off.
That is weird, but I'm looking forward to it,
mm-hmm.
as I do with all of the series that come out. Well, thank you very much, Brian, for talking to me about Atomic Robo.
No problem.
I really appreciate it, and thanks for all the great stories, and looking forward to more.
Cool. Thanks for talking with me.
Yeah, great. Have a good Saturday.
You too.
Bye, Brian.
Adios.
Thank you for listening to the 12th episode of Colloquium with Brian Clevenger. You can find out more about Brian and Atomic Robo on the official website, atomic-robo.com. Brian's also on Twitter, at @bclevenger. Please take a moment and visit patreon.com/tesladyne to help Brian put out as many robo-adventures as possible. There are some great pledge rewards for contributing to the Atomic cause. For more about Colloquium, visit the Sequart Research and Literacy Organization website at sequart.org. Along with the cast, you'll find reviews, documentaries, scholarly articles, and many unique books that discuss and analyze your favorite comic book series and creators. Big thank you to John Raffano, who wrote and performed the Colloquium theme song. John is the guitarist for the post-rock metal band Sonhet. You can listen to the band's music at sonhet.bandcamp.com. Until next time, chums.